Artery with Isa Caveggia, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In each episode of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist specializing in a particular cultural context has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of authorship and responsibility in art. In this episode, Fran Edmonds, a researcher at the University of Melbourne, speaks with Marie Clark. This episode is a field recording, so it means that you might hear some of the sounds outdoors, but it will hopefully also give you a flavour of ethnographic fieldwork. I will hand over to Fran to introduce herself and her guest.
It's Fran Edmonds here. We're in Marie Clark's backyard, which is in Yarraville, in the inner city suburb of Yarraville, yes, in the inner city suburb of Melbourne. I'm Fran. I'm a researcher at the University of Melbourne, and I've been working with Marie for probably the last 20 years. Marie was actually my field supervisor for my PhD and has been a mentor to me ever since, basically. Introduced me to everybody really in the art world, in the Aboriginal art world in Victoria. And between us, we've kind of just cruised along for the past 20 years, talking about art, writing about art, and hanging out in Marie's backyard. Ree, do you want to introduce yourself and who you are and what you do?
So my name's Marie Clark. I've been a practicing artist for over 30 years. Moved to Melbourne in, 1988 to paint the first green and gold tram to hit the tracks of Melbourne, and basically went back up to Mildura in northwest Victoria, packed up my little flat, moved back to Melbourne. And I've been working as an artist and curator ever since. And then, met Fran many, many moons ago. And we've travelled around the state a bit and sort of, been working on different projects. And the most recent being the Living Archive of Aboriginal Art, where basically we document everything that goes on in my backyard that will get uploaded eventually to this brilliant archive that will then be accessible for community and for young people, and it'll be full of stories and images and films. And I do a lot of work with my great-nephew, Mitch Marnie, and we've been making little mini docos here in the backyard just using our mobile phone to connect with a community up north at Nooka. And so it could be on, the documentary could be on the grinding of ochre pigment and making that into a paint and using wattle resin as a fixative in that, or Mitch taking the sinew out of the tail of a kangaroo to make, kangaroo tooth necklaces, or to create a thread. But all of these different little processes, we document, basically everything. The plucking of the birds. I'm just sitting here now, and there's about 10 containers of feathers from all different types of birds that my husband collected a couple of weeks ago. And then just over on this other little table is a blue bucket full of the jaws of a kangaroo. Now, these are all just sitting in situ, just waiting for the ABC to come around later this week to make another little documentary for the art show. But basically my house is like being surrounded with everything.
So on that, Ree, we'll try and stick to the guidelines that they've got here, which is around authorship and art. So the idea is for you to talk a little bit about the work you make and how you go about making the work, and how you feel about deciding on who, how you name yourself as the author when a lot of your work is quite collaboratively based.
Mm.
Yeah. Oh, so now here's Mitch Marnie Marie was just talking about.
Yes.
We're making a podcast, Mitch. This is what happens in Marie's backyard all the time.
There's always someone popping in.
People popping in.
Work to be made.
So we're talking about how Marie... how she decides on what kind of work she's going to make, and always there's people involved in the making of the work, and how you decide on authorship of that work.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that this is going to be caught up in a very culturally based kind of process as well, around, who has the authority to make the art and that kind of thing.
Oh, I think anybody has the authority to make the art. I think what makes my work quite different is that absolutely everything that I do, I'm sharing, with Mitch and the other nieces and nephews. And like this next body of work where I need 8 of the nieces and nephews, but it's my idea, my intellectual property, but I'm sharing that knowledge and creating other avenues of mourning, if you like, and looking at that in a different way.
Well, you're talking about mourning, but what if it's, people don't know what the mourning practice is that you're talking about specifically.
Yeah. Oh, so...
Do you want to talk about that?
I guess, when we talk about mourning, I should also mention that we used to make like Kopi caps, which are referenced as widow's caps, but they were also worn by men, and you would wear like a clay cap on your head weighing up to 7 kilos, and you would wear that either until it fell off your head or at the end of your mourning period, take it off and place it on the grave. So I think a lot of my work sort of references mourning and this next body of work that I'm making with the dresses, and I have 3 flowers that I'm referencing as death flowers. Everything I do, I'm sharing that knowledge and stories with my family.
So is there any work that you feel... it's a difficult question because all your work is so collaborative, but is there any work that you have ever felt that you're not the author of, even though you've been named as the maker of?
No, I don't think so.
I can't think of anything.
Because I get the idea to make these supersized things, and to make these supersized 50-metre necklaces is... to then get a team of people to help me make and create. The boys love going down to the river to collect the river reeds. It's quite a laborious thing to do.
Who are the boys?
The husband Nicholas and Mitch and Tobias have all been down the river to collect the river reeds.
Tobias is
Nicholas's son. And then once you get at home, you have to bundle them, tape them, cut them.
So these are the... we're looking at a big red bucket full of cut river reed. There must be how many...
One bucket would make 50-metre river reed necklaces.
Okay, wow. And they're all cut to size, and they're about, 2 centimetres long?
Yeah. So we do that sort of, you've got to get all the husks off them, then you've got to sort them. I then dye them, dry them, drill them, glue feathers. And once you get to that stage, it's like gluing the feathers is just like another whole process in itself.
And can you tell us about how you get the feathers? So who goes out and collects them?
So for the feathers, and Nicholas... just came back with his mate Reuben last week from doing a big 1,000-kilometre road trip up into central New South Wales before COVID, and came back with five or six dead birds from galahs, cockatoos, crows.
Were they mainly, hawks, beautiful. Yeah. Were they mainly roadkill or they just...
Or roadkill.
Mm.
So they collected the birds and then also a whole bucket full of kangaroo teeth. So basically to make the kangaroo tooth necklace, you have to stop at all the dead kangaroos and pull their teeth out. And so Nicholas has a particular hunting knife, tin snips, pliers, and just steel cap boots.
So when we're talking about this, you're the sole, you're the main author of these artworks. When we're saying author, we mean maker.
Yeah.
And so why are you the main author if there's all these people? This is like, I'm just asking these questions for us to try and think through this process a little bit. Why are you the named main author?
Because I guess I was the one that instigated the remaking and creating of these cultural items that were held in museum collections. And I could quite easily go out and collect all of these materials myself. But absolutely everything I do, I like to share that knowledge and that experience. And it's a whole experience getting in a car, travelling 1,000 kilometres and stopping at the dead kangaroos. And I photograph all the kangaroos that I take the teeth from, so I've got a whole collection of photographs. But also to share that knowledge and information of collecting, then it's another process when you get it home, which is boiling, getting the plaque off the teeth and preparing it, preparing the sinew, taking the sinew from the tail of a kangaroo, which the boys do.
So that's like, I've heard you talk about that as...
men's business.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and I'm vegan and I just can't do that side of it. And I know I could if I had to, but there are always men around that want to do that process. And I've taught my nieces and nephews how to put together a kangaroo tooth necklace, and Nicholas has shown the boys how to take the sinew, and he's shown the girls how to take the sinew out of the tail of a kangaroo. So we need that sinew to bind the tooth to kangaroo leather when we're making the kangaroo tooth necklaces.
Mm.
But we've also used organic kangaroo teeth in my new 3D printed jewellery collection, where there are 3D printed teeth, but we've used an organic tooth in that mix.
Mm.
So people see what an organic tooth looks like alongside a 3D printed 18 karat gold plated kangaroo tooth or the plasticky sort of 3D printed tooth.
So it's interesting, that conversation. So, you know, you've started off like it's quite a, I guess, for want of a better word, a traditional skill that you've adapted and changed to very contemporary times. So the whole conversation shifts from collecting carcasses and stripping them and doing things that back in the day people would have done however many thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And now
I'm getting like a company in New York to 3D print me 18 karat gold plated kangaroo teeth or the plastic teeth. But to me it's continuing cultural practice and keeping culture alive in the 21st century using new materials. And just consider that the kangaroo only has 2 bottom incisor teeth that we can use for the necklace. So that's an awful lot of kangaroos when you're making a 75-tooth necklace.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be out on the road for a week and not collect as many teeth as what Nicholas and Ruben collected.
Yeah.
Because what we're finding, and this is a couple of years ago, where I did another huge trip up into New South Wales and back, was that the local councils are collecting the dead kangaroos and moving them off the side of the road, and I don't know where they're taking them. Mm. But we're talking like you're in the middle of nowhere, you should see a lot of dead kangaroos. So for us it's about the supply of those.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting too, how you establish these relationships with people. So there's family, obviously, that, you know, central to the process of learning alongside you and assisting you, but also those relationships with professional bodies and technicians. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Canberra Glassworks and the and that relationship and how you go about
having people fabricate
my work. And then how you decide on authorship around that kind of process as well?
Well, I guess, you know, like any sort of public artwork where you, the artist, have the idea to create and make this work, but you don't have the physical skills to either weld or to blow glass. And I worked a couple of years ago with Canberra Glassworks, where I flew to Canberra with a little piece of a little circle of plastic and a sketch of an eel trap and asked them if they could proportionally make me a 3 metre glass eel trap in 20 sections, because I wanted it to look really contemporary and different, and I just wanted clear glass. And they'd shown me all these very busy glasses, you know, beautiful shapes and colours and everything, but I just wanted clear glass that you could see through. So they ended up making me one 3 metre glass eel trap in 20 sections. And it's, creating a relationship with that company that can then realise your vision. So they did that really well and then offered me a solo exhibition where they then made me a second glass eel trap, and I invited Mitch Marnie, my nephew, to be part of that exhibition too. And he wanted to make glass possum pelts that he then etched designs into, and he used this other coloured glass to create images that represent men and women that I created for one of my paintings years ago. But it's like we're now also creating designs that represent us. And it's, you know, always telling story and continue to tell stories, which is how culture and knowledge is passed on.
So it's like, so we're just looking at some glass beads that Marie had.
So these are glass river reeds. So for the exhibition at Canberra Glassworks, so this is the sound of all of these beautiful glass river reeds, and they even have the little kinks in them. And they also made me glass seed pods, which I fill with ochre and charcoal from country. And I call those a moment in time because they're capturing a moment in time from country. And that's fantastic. And what I will then do with all of the different works that I do is pass this on to, you know, my nieces and nephews so that they can, in the future, use these designs or materials in their own work.
So I'm just going to kind of fast forward to now. We've been talking about Marie's process of she's done a lot of research in museums around revivifying her ancestral material culture in the museums. Do you want to talk about that relationship between that work and then how that's carried forward into Marie has a very big retrospective at the Premier Art Gallery in Victoria, which is the National Gallery of Victoria. She's the first living Victorian Aboriginal artist and a woman artist at that to have a show, a solo show at the NGV. So it's pretty special in a way. And so a lot of her work is based on around these this research practice. Do you want to talk about how that's how you around the authorship of that, because it is comes from ancestral knowledge in a way, isn't it? So what's the title of the exhibition and that kind of thing?
The exhibition's called Ancestral Memories, and I guess that came about from the eel trap, because the eels have ancestral memory and go back to the place of their parents. But also, I guess because of all the research that I do in museum collections, around the world and looking at our material cultural items held in those collections and also here in Melbourne. And then learning how some of these objects and items were put together and relearning that skill of putting them together, going out on country, collecting materials, and then fabricating that. Now, we've only seen a few sketches. There's not an awful lot of writing about these objects and how they were put together. So I think what we're doing, and especially sort of using the Living Archive as a platform to keep that information, but absolutely documenting everything that we do, from, you know, collecting the river reeds. In my exhibition, there's a really early river reed necklace. It's absolutely beautiful.
Well, that's from?
From, borrowed from the Melbourne Museum.
Yeah. And there's quite a few other things.
Objects.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the river reed necklace goes from that to the smaller ones held in the, like, the contemporary ones in the glass case, to the big 50-metre ones hanging on the wall.
Mm.
And
they're all yours, so the glass case ones are your early river reeds.
Yeah, from, I think, one borrowed from the Koorie Heritage Trust, which was the first one that Len and I had put together.
So Len Tregoning was a Gunno man who was...
Yeah, so Len was a Gunno man, and we, from Gippsland, from Lake Tyres Aboriginal Trust, and we made the first 27-tooth and then 75-tooth kangaroo tooth necklace, but he also put together the biggest kangaroo tooth necklace to date with 123 teeth. And he bound that necklace in one sitting. Like, it took quite a while, quite a few hours.
And both of you are named as the makers of that object, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. So that was pretty incredible. And now, you know, in that glass case is the other kangaroo tooth necklace where Nicholas had shown the nieces and nephews how to pull the sinew out. They bound the teeth, and that has one of the 18-carat gold-plated kangaroo teeth in it. And then...
Is this in the show?
My exhibition at the NGV. And then it sort of moves from the early echidna quill necklaces to the river reed necklaces to the kangaroo tooth necklaces and then to the glass. Mm. And so the glass river reed necklaces are, glass. So Canberra Glass Works fabricated all of the glass river reeds. And then I used an organic river reed, dyed black, and glued feathers into it. And it's absolutely beautiful.
Mm.
So there are some big 10-metre glass river reed necklaces hanging on the wall there too.
So it is a spectacular exhibition. So how do you describe your relationship to that artwork? Like, it ranges from your black and white photographs, which are part of what Maria's
from
referred
the early
to.
90s.
Yeah, and that they're forming part of the Living Archive that we're working on together, which is trying to establish stories in connection with Maria's artwork. And
and I guess...
So it goes from that to to the possum skin cloak.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's an amazing exhibition. So how do you, the relationship that you have with these artworks?
You know, I think, well, there's a lot of memory in this show, and sort of when you look at the black and white photographs, which are, you know, either of generations of families together or portraits of people or the NAIDOC marches.
NAIDOC, do you want to tell people what NAIDOC is?
So NAIDOC is sort of National Aboriginal Week, where there's this celebration of Aboriginal culture, and it's a week-long celebration in Australia where, Aboriginal people are the focus of a whole range of things. So I used to, and there's a big march throughout the city.
And this year Ash Barty won Wimbledon.
Yes.
Which is amazing.
But, to go on these NAIDOC marches and always trying to keep ahead of the crowd so you get these great crowd shots of, you know, hundreds of people, you know, marching down the street, you know, and they're called the Land Rights Marches, and people holding banners and placards and things. And then, yeah, there's a big celebration later. But it was pretty amazing to see some of those photographs in the exhibition, which a lot of those photos I hadn't printed before. So to see them was, you know, lots of memories in those photos. And then, you know, you turn to the right and you see all the mourning photos and...
Oh, you do want to describe the historical
Kopi mourning cap, which is held in the museum collection. And that Kopi mourning cap was collected by George Murray Black, who had travelled the Murray-Darling Rivers, taking the skeletal remains from country, the ancestral remains, and they ended up back at the Melbourne Museum and Melbourne University. So along with the skeletal remains, they'd taken these Kopi mourning caps, the widow caps. And the skeletal remains were eventually returned back to country that could be provenanced. And the other ones are buried in the Domain Gardens, in the Botanical Gardens in Melbourne, with a plaque representing or mentioning all 38 tribes of Victoria. And they're buried under this big boulder. And there was a big procession down St Kilda Road for the reburial. And those ancestral remains were wrapped in paper bark and then placed in this grave and then buried under the big boulder. Well, in 2010, did some research on the mourning practices of my own mob because I didn't know.
So you haven't told people who your mob is yet.
Sorry. When I talk about mob, I'm talking about community. And, you know, I'm connected to quite a few different traditional groups here in Australia, from New South Wales and Victoria. And my connection also goes back to Tipperary in Ireland and Dunstable in the UK. And Tasmania, but I have also represented on my cloak all the different countries that I'm connected to. And I love that I had some green ochre where I could represent Tipperary and Dunstable, because without Amelia Gill, the great-great-grandmother five times back from Tipperary, and George Briggs from Dunstable in the UK... we might be here, but just in another form. And I don't know what that would look like. Yeah. But
those ancestral connections back to country along the Murray, which is where you grew up, really.
Yeah, the Murray, Murrumbidgee, Darling Rivers. Mm. So
that's where a lot of those mourning practices that you're talking about, the Kopi caps and things.
Yeah. So I was lucky enough to work with, like, 38 Aboriginal women to represent the 38 tribes of Victoria. And they're all wearing this mourning marking that, you know, which is like a white ochre across your eyes and white ochre in your hair. And I made their Kopi mourning caps. And then I went on to work with, I don't know, 45 Aboriginal men and made their Kopis. But I'd also designed 7 T-shirts for the men to wear to represent the scars that they would have worn during... no ritual, ceremony, mourning, and I coloured their kopis with red ochre to represent bloodletting, and that's like hitting yourself on the head with a bundi or something so that you bleed. And the weight of your kopi mourning cap, which weighed up to 7 kilos, is to feel the weight of your grief and to carry that for an extended period of time. So that when you took it off, you're quite free to move on and you can feel it. It's physical. It's quite amazing.
So it sort of makes me think, like, all of these practices involve other people. You're not doing this all by yourself. So what do you feel is the responsibility you have then in the making of this art? What kind of responsibility do you feel?
I guess, you know, one, I'm lucky enough to be able to work in an area that I'm so passionate about and to share that knowledge with my family. And I guess it's to try and leave a legacy or something for them, because they're all so interested and they're all part of my artwork, my practice. And whatever I'm making, whatever I'm doing, I'm always including other people. And I think it's, I don't know, it just makes the work much more interesting.
Mm.
You know, when we sewed the 63 pelt possum skin cloak, which was...
Which takes up, like, it does fill that almighty space in the NGV, which is... How big is that wall? It's massive.
It's a big wall.
But not high ceilings.
It's like 9 metre ceilings, mm, and the width, that cloak is probably 3.5 metres wide, 4 metres wide probably.
Mm. But what were we saying about the nieces and nephews?
When we made the cloak here in my backyard, we had quite a few family and friends come around and help sew the cloak. And I just live in this tiny, weeny inner city sort of place with a little concrete backyard and three puppies who you would have heard before. But I did not have a space big enough to lay out the 63 pelts, so I had to take it over to my gallery, like my gallery representative, and had to lay the pelts out on her floor and cut the pelts over there,
yeah,
and then label them, number them and bundle them to bring them home. And, yeah, it's a bit of a process then when you start sewing.
Yeah.
Because,
it's a learning. Like, I'm not a great sewer, and the more when you do it and you don't do it as I'm not a regular possum sewer or possum skin cloak sewer, and it is very hard work. Marie's hands are testament to the...
Well, they're much better now.
Yeah, but they can really wreak havoc on...
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking too, and I'm just reflecting on some things I've heard you say in the past around... there was a question that someone asked the other day to you about how do you get permission to make, if these are connected to ancestral items, and have you ever had any back flack from people or anybody come up to you and ask, you know, question you about your responsibility or your rights to make particular objects?
Well, I don't see anybody else out there making the work that I do. When I made the first lot of Kopi morning caps, I got permission off my elders to make that work.
And how do you go about that process, Ree?
Well, I talked to one of my aunties before she passed a few years ago, whether or not it was okay for me to actually make that work, because we're talking about, you know, a morning practice that hasn't been practiced down in the southeast, you know, for quite some time.
Mm.
And it was still practiced after invasion, because some of those historical Kopi caps had European material on the inside, whereas traditionally women would weave a net of emu sinew, place it on their head and plaster their head with gypsum. And you can see the different weaves inside the Kopi morning caps from the different areas, which had a slightly different weave.
Right.
But some also had this European material, printed material.
Okay.
Inside the cap.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they've built them up.
Mm.
I have to show you an image.
Mm.
But, you know, that tells me that even after invasion, people were doing that, but people aren't doing that in the southeast anymore. And quite possibly in more remote communities, I would say people would be... still wearing the kopi, wearing the white mourning marking. And when Len passed away a few years ago, we had ochre on the table as people walked in that could, you know, mark their face.
Yeah, this is at his funeral.
With the ochre, and that hadn't happened in any other sort of, you know, funeral ceremony that I'd been to. And... you remember for that one we got the five elders of the five clans of the Kulin Nation to do a smoking ceremony for him and brought him in. And it was the first time the Melbourne Museum had actually had a ceremony like that in Bundjalaka, the Aboriginal Museum based within the museum, where, you know, they were sending somebody back home to country because normally it's the ancestral remains that they take.
And keep in storage.
Yeah, and it was just incredible to be able to do that at the Melbourne Museum because Len had such a great relationship and was instrumental in the development of Bundjalaka, and they were just honoured that we'd asked them if we could have his ceremony there because, you know, he wasn't religious and, you know, Western society's mourning practices just don't work for Aboriginal people and they don't work for Western people, I don't think. And so to be able to then create our own ceremony where the coffin was painted by an Aboriginal artist from the same country where Len was from. So to be able to do that and then have the smoking ceremony and had him wrapped in his own possum skin cloak for burial and send him back home was pretty amazing. Yeah.
I'm just thinking while you're talking, there's a lot of responsibility that you have, like, on your shoulders in terms of maintaining that practice. So while your work is, like, always collaborative and very community-based, the idea around authorship that you hold, I guess, is do you think it's a fair enough thing to say that it is a responsibility that you take really, really, you know, seriously?
You have to, because we're talking about, you know, the continuation of cultural practice and sharing that knowledge with that next generation. And, you know, I guess I'm lucky enough now that my great-nephew, who I do a lot of projects and work with...
This is Mitch, who's just in the kitchen.
Mitch Marnie. Yeah, we've got this other project we're working on together. But just so lucky that he's now working at the Melbourne Museum with our, you know, material cultural items and held in the museum collection. And, you know, we're planning like 1-2 years down the track of making these other sort of supersized, incredible objects out of glass and a whole range of things. Yeah, so, no, it's fantastic. And I know it's a huge responsibility, and I just hope I do it sort of in a really respectful way of doing that research, but also sharing that knowledge with this next generation, which I absolutely love.
Mitch, this is like, we haven't asked Mitch if he wants to contribute, but
no,
I'm sure.
Happy to.
So this is Mitch Marnie. Mitch, we're just talking to, this is a podcast for some people in England that are doing it with other artists who work collaboratively around the world. Do you want to just introduce yourself quickly and talk a little bit about how you've been working with Marie and what, you know, your kind of role in...
Absolutely. So I'm Mitch Marnie. I'm a Bunurong fella. And I've been working with Aunty Marie forever. But ever since I was a little kid, going along to possum skin cloak workshop.
Well, how old are you now?
I'm 24 this year. trying to remember. yeah, I've been working with Aunty Marie ever since I was little tacker going along to workshops. But in the last, I think, what is it, 2 years, maybe 3 years, since I've been in Melbourne, I've really been working alongside Aunty Marie in quite a few different project possum skin cloak workshops, the Footscray Community Arts Eel Track project, helping out with a solo exhibition at Mildura, an NGV solo exhibition, everything and anything. I'm always around helping out.
Since Mitch moved to Melbourne, he has not stopped working as an artist.
Working as a full-time artist, then with a part-time job that generally links into my practice anyway.
So Mitch is working at the Melbourne Museum. with our collection items and...
Yeah, I currently work at Melbourne Museum as an assistant curator with Kimberly Moulton in the Southeastern Aboriginal Collection. So looking at all Southeastern Aboriginal cultural items, helping people come into the collections and engage with their cultural items, looking at what's on display in Bundjalaka, any aspects around the Southeastern Collection we generally work with.
Mm. It's a big responsibility too, like we were just talking about Marie's.
Yeah, huge.
Yeah, because the thing about a lot of those collections is they're unprovenance, so you've got the name of the collector, but you don't really have the story connected to the item.
That seems to be one of the key things is a lot of, you know, really getting into people who know these items and know their stories and then building on those narratives of items that are in collections because of that exact reason. We've got items that are unprovenance in terms of their mob. They might have a location, like a general locality, but they don't really have who their mob is. And then even items that are, you know, they are provenance, they have where they're collected from, who the mob was that they're collected of, and maybe even something like maybe the traditional name, and that being very rare, those items still don't have a large narrative around what they were used for, how they were used, that is directly linked into the archive. A lot of that information is extra information that you have to source from other areas, where it's something Melbourne Museum really wants to try and push is having all that information in the archive with the items so that you can really learn right there on the spot what these items are.
So I'm thinking, I was just thinking too in terms of, because you both, like, do research into collections, and when you were doing the kangaroo tooth necklace for Marie's solo exhibition in Mildura in 2019, and there was a whole mob of people around here, working with you.
All the nieces and nephews.
In 2019.
Yeah, I know, it seems ages ago, and you actually were, like, that was your first kangaroo tooth, and it was, it was Marie's solo exhibition, but you were very much a part of that process.
Yeah.
How do you see that as, like, your role in that kind of process?
Well, it was that necklace, but also the possum skin cloak.
Yeah, and the possum skin cloak,
which was just incredible.
Amazing.
It's that process of being passed down knowledge, and for me it was an opportunity for me to help teach my cousins the knowledge I'd been passed down of possum skin cloaks. But then at the same time, you know, in the exact same workshop being passed down a new knowledge of kangaroo tooth necklace making. And it's really special for me to be involved in that because it's part of, you know, connection to who you are, your mob, those people, but also because it's something I'm always so interested in. When I look at our cultural items in the museum, I just want to know how they're made and I want to learn that process. The process of making is really the story for me. So having Aunty Marie, well, that's kind of something I've learnt from anyway, is that process of making and the journey being part of that whole narrative.
And I know, just harking back, Ree, like we were talking that, you know, when I said, oh, it's probably a cultural kind of phenomena around you being named as an author, like it's something that you have the knowledge and have you earned the right to be the solo author of.
Yeah.
And Mitch is in this position where he acknowledges that, I guess, like in his, I mean, and that's something I see, not just in your relationship, but within relationships in community.
Well, what we were talking about last week is, like, we're creating these new stories and new designs and new things to sort of carry forward, because if you don't change and adapt and create these stories, I believe culture will die. And we're reviving and bringing back historical practices and making them true to, you know, the collection items. But then we're also, you know, using new technologies and new materials to continue the story. Mm. But it's all based on historical content in museum collections, and that's what I love to do.
And that, what were you saying before about the 60,000, that great...
I always get asked, and especially with the show now at the NGV, what would you like people to go away with once they see your exhibition? What would you like them to take away with them? And I've been asked that question so many times in the last 2 weeks. And the other day I just thought, you know what, this is 60,000 years of making, creating and passing on knowledge and sharing that information and journey with my family, but with other family and friends that come to my home. And I hope that people see that in the exhibition from the historical items, because there's the Kopi mourning cap, there's the river reed necklace and the kangaroo tooth necklace. And we've recreated, and I say we because it's my family and I and friends that have been involved in the making and creating, but this stems back to over 60,000 years, so we're still continuing today in the 21st century these practices that have been passed on for thousands of generations.
Mm.
And we're just, you know, one little drop in this whole story.
So we don't have, like, we only had to do 40 minutes, but I just want to put this last question to you both.
Yeah.
And, Marie, I know you'll have something to say about this. Mm. Where's your preferred place to make and create art?
Here in my backyard. I don't like moving far from here. It's like just being embedded in so much in this backyard. And, you know, Mitch came home one day with this huge boulder of a rock of red ochre. So whenever he needs ochre or I need ochre, we just walk out the back, get the tomahawk, scrape off a bit, grind that up, use that with whatever we're making, use it for the glass seed pods. But yeah, I've been offered studios, but it's like, no, I just like to be surrounded with materials here in my backyard.
And do you think that's got to do with family and people being here with you as well?
Yeah, well, you know, even now today, Fran, since you've been here, like Mitch has popped in and Nicholas is inside and there's a couple of other people there that have helped, you know, collect different materials, the birds, the kangaroo teeth. So there's always something going on in this backyard.
Yeah. What about you, Mitch? Like,
no, same. I do a little bit at my own house, but to be honest, I like to be here. It's just easy. Everything's here. I don't even need here.
How about that canoe, the marquette of the canoe?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Coming here is easy. Like, everything's here. It's just so much easier to do the work. We've only made here for the health and just so that the space is, I don't know how to describe it. Yeah. The space is just a creative space. And to be honest, it's a space where you can come and be creative and not get as distracted. I find whenever I work at other studios or at home, I'm always getting overly distracted. When I come here, I can really focus and get something done. And if we don't get anything done, we have good conversations to replace getting that stuff done.
Yeah, we've done that before.
Yeah.
And then when I turn up, it becomes like
another thing.
Well, that was great. And thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this? I mean, it is going to be probably edited down a bit, but
yeah. Well, I reckon if people just get online and have a look at the exhibition online and
this is the
see all the different making and creating and I think all of those images are online.
Mm.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
No worries.
Yeah, thank you.
This was Artery with Isa Kavegia, a podcast on art, authorship and anthropology, supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. Hope to speak with you again soon.